All right, buckle up, everyone, because today we're diving deep into a Supreme Court case that really gets to the heart of what it means to have effective legal counsel, Padilla v. Kentucky.
A case that sits right at that intersection of criminal law and immigration law and really exposes just how vulnerable non-citizens can be in our criminal justice system.
Exactly. So we're talking about Jose Padilla, a legal permanent resident who ends up facing deportation after a drug charge.
And here's the kicker. His lawyer never even mentioned that deportation was a possibility. Didn't advise him on it at all.
So that failure to advise, that's what lands this case in the Supreme Court, right?
Yeah.
They had to decide, does the Sixth Amendment's right to counsel, does that include advice about potential deportation?
Even though, as you say, deportation happens after the criminal trial is done, it's a consequence that comes later. Big question the court had to grapple with.
Huge implications, for sure. And luckily for us, we've got some amazing source material to work with today. Not just excerpts from the case brief, but the full opinions from the justices themselves. So we're not just getting the legal framework, we're getting their thought processes, their arguments in their own words.
Having those different perspectives, the majority, the concurrence, the dissent, it really reveals the complexity, the struggle the court had with this issue. No easy answers.
Definitely not. Okay, so let's start with that case brief, kind of the Cliff Notes version, right? Walk us through it. What's the rule of law at play here?
Well, you could say the court kind of established a new rule with this case. Basically, lawyers now have to tell their clients if a plea deal could lead to deportation. If they don't, it can be seen as ineffective assistance of counsel. Straight up violation of that Sixth Amendment.
Wow. So that's huge. Even though deportation isn't technically part of a criminal sentence, lawyers can't just ignore it. Suddenly it's part of their responsibility. Adds a whole other layer to advising their clients.
Exactly. It makes you think about just how delicate that lawyer-client relationship is and how much is riding on it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So the rule of law, that sets the stage. But what was the specific issue in Padilla's case? What were they arguing about?
Basically, the court was trying to figure out if the Sixth Amendment, that guarantee of effective counsel, does it specifically include a duty to inform non-citizen clients about potential deportation, especially when they're considering a guilty plea.
So it's not just like being a generally good lawyer. It's about this very specific obligation when you've got a non-citizen client.
Right. And this is all happening, by the way, against the backdrop of immigration laws that are getting stricter and stricter.
Right. That context matters a lot. And, you know, the facts of Padilla's case really bring home the human side of all this. He'd been in the U.S. over 40 years. And get this, he served in Vietnam. This isn't just a name on a legal document. It's a real person with a life, with a past.
Definitely adds a layer of moral weight to the legal arguments, doesn't it? What kind of country are we if this is how we treat someone who served?
Big questions. So after all that, what did the court actually decide?
They sided with Padilla, reversed the lower court's decision. Basically, they said any competent lawyer would have told Padilla that his drug conviction could get him deported.
So, win for Padilla. But I bet a lot of lawyers out there listening were sweating a bit, thinking about their past cases.
I imagine so. And, you know, another thing that makes this case so interesting, it wasn't a unanimous decision. You had concurring and dissenting opinions.
Ah, yeah, you mentioned that earlier. Multiple opinions. What does that tell us? Why is that important?
Well, to me, it signals just how tough this issue was, that there wasn't one clear-cut answer. The court really struggled with it.
I see. So you've got the majority opinion, that's the main ruling. Then you've got the concurrence, where a justice agrees with the outcome, but maybe has different reasons or some doubts.
Right. And then, of course, you've got the dissent, where a justice flat-out disagrees with majority.
Right. A good old-fashioned judicial debate. Sounds like it's time to dive into those opinions. Starting with the majority, Justice Stevens wrote that one. What were his key arguments?
Well, one thing that really struck me was how Stevens talked about deportation. He didn't mince words, called it a drastic measure, even compared it to banishment or exile.
Wow. Deportation as exile. That's powerful.
And then he went on to point out how much harsher immigration law has become. How for a lot of crimes, deportation's basically automatic now.
No more second chances, huh? So in Stevens' view, what made the lawyer's failure to advise Padilla so bad? Was it just the severity of deportation?
Well, that was part of it, for sure. But Stevens also said that in Padilla's case, the law was crystal clear. There were no two ways about it. The lawyer should have known deportation was on the table.
So not only was deportation a serious consequence, it was a highly likely one. And the lawyer just dropped the ball.
Yeah, he really did. And to understand the full impact of all this, we have to talk about something called the JRD.
The JRA. You mentioned that earlier. Remind me what that's all about. Why is it relevant to this case?
So the JRA stands for Judicial Recommendation Against Deportation. It used to be a really important part of the system. Basically, judges could recommend against deportation even if someone was convicted of something that could lead to it.
So it was a way to give judges some discretion to consider individual circumstances, even if the law itself was pretty harsh.
Right. But Congress got rid of the JRA back in 1990, so all of a sudden, the stakes for non-citizens, they skyrocketed. Before, you could get convicted but still have a judge step in and say, don't deport this person.
Wow, so that safety net was just gone. No wonder Stevens was so focused on the need for good legal advice. It's a whole new ball game without the JRA.
A much riskier game, that's for sure.
Okay, so we've got Stevens laying out a powerful argument for expanding the Sixth Amendment, making advice about deportation a core part of effective counsel. But of course, not everyone on the court agreed, right?
Oh, definitely not. This is the Supreme Court, after all. And Justice Scalia, he was never one to shy away from a strong opinion. He wrote a pretty fiery dissent in this case.
Justice Scalia, always good for a lively debate. What was his main beef with the majority opinion?
Well, Scalia was a big believer in what we call textualism, sticking to the literal meaning of the law as written. And his argument basically boiled down to this. The Sixth Amendment says defense. It doesn't say anything about giving advice on everything that could happen after the trial's over.
So he's saying Stevens and the majority, they're trying to read too much into the Sixth Amendment, stretching it too far.
Exactly. To Scalia, the Sixth Amendment protects your right to a lawyer during the trial itself, not for the whole rest of your life.
Makes sense from a textualist point of view. Did he have any other concern?
Oh, he did. He brought up the slippery slope argument. Basically, if lawyers have to advise on deportation, what's next? Where does it stop? What other consequences will courts say they have to advise on?
I see. It's like opening Pandora's box.
Right. He saw this ruling as potentially creating a whole avalanche of legal obligations for lawyers.
Okay, so we've got Stevens on one end of the spectrum, Scalia on the other. Where did Justice Alito land on all this?
Alito took more of a middle ground approach. He concurred with the judgment, meaning he agreed with the outcome, but he had some reservations.
Interesting. So he agreed that giving bad advice about deportation is a problem. But he wasn't totally on board with the majority's reasoning.
Right. His main concern was about practicality, you know, forcing every criminal lawyer to suddenly become an immigration expert. He thought that was unrealistic.
Yeah, I can see that. Immigration law is notoriously complex. Even experienced lawyers can get tripped up.
Exactly. He even used some examples in his opinion. Things like aggravated felonies, crimes involving moral turpitude. Those terms have really specific meanings. And figuring out if a particular crime fits those definitions, it can be super tricky.
So basically, he's acknowledging that even if we want lawyers to advise on these issues, we have to be realistic about how hard it is.
Exactly.
Okay, so we've got three very different viewpoints. Stevens focused on how serious deportation is. Scalia worried about overreach. And Alito trying to find that practical middle ground.
It's a real judicial puzzle, isn't it? And it shows just how much is at stake when the Supreme Court interprets something as fundamental as the Sixth Amendment.
Absolutely. We started with this dry case brief, the legal bones of the issue. And now we're hearing these justices grappling with these massive questions.
It's like going from reading a textbook to suddenly being in the courtroom, feeling the tension, the weight of these decisions.
Exactly. And we can't forget, this isn't just some abstract legal debate. Padilla's story, his service in Vietnam, facing deportation because of a lawyer's mistake. It reminds us this is about real people's lives.
Definitely. And it brings up some pretty uncomfortable questions about fairness, about what it means to truly belong in this country, even if you weren't born here.
Yeah, some heavy stuff to ponder. But that's what we're here for, right? To dive deep into these complex issues, and we're just getting started.
Heavy stuff indeed. And Padilla's case really brings that home, doesn't it? The human cost of these legal battles.
No kidding. I mean, the guy served in Vietnam, builds a life here, and then this happens. It's a reminder that these legal decisions have real-world consequences for people.
Absolutely. And it underscores just how crucial it is to have effective legal counsel, especially for non-citizens who might not fully grasp all the ins and outs of the U.S. legal system.
I hear you. Okay, so we've got the basics down. The rule of law, the issue in Padilla's case, the court's decision, and those all-important multiple opinions. But now I'm ready to really dig into the reasoning behind those different viewpoints. Let's get back to those full opinions. What were some of the most striking arguments in Justice Stevens' majority opinion?
Well, one thing that stood out to me was this line. Deportation is a particularly severe penalty, and one that frequently is more severe than the punishment imposed for the crime conviction. It just drives home the point that we're not talking about a slap on the wrist here. Deportation is life-altering.
It's huge, not just for Bedia, but for anyone facing that possibility. Did Stevens elaborate on that, connect it back to the need for good legal advice?
He did. He wrote that the consequences of deportation are so serious that advice regarding deportation is not categorically removed from the ambit of the Sixth Amendment right to counsel. Basically, he's saying that in this day and age, with deportation looming so large, you can't claim to be providing effective counsel if you're ignoring it.
It's almost like he's saying you have to see the bigger picture. It's not just about the immediate criminal charges. It's about those long-term consequences that a non-citizen might not even be aware of.
Exactly. The Sixth Amendment doesn't just guarantee a warm body next to you in court. It guarantees counsel that's truly effective, and that means understanding all the potential ramifications.
Makes sense. What else from Stevens' opinion resonated with you?
Well, he also delved into the history of how immigration law and criminal law have become increasingly intertwined. He traced how deportation has become almost automatic for so many crimes now.
So it's not just that lawyers need to advise about deportation. It's that it's become the default in many cases. The stakes are even higher now.
Absolutely. And Stevens argued that lawyers have a duty to stay informed about these changes, to keep up with the times and advise their clients accordingly.
So like a continuing education requirement for lawyers, almost.
Yeah.
You can't just rely on what you learned in law school. You have to be on top of how the legal landscape is changing.
Exactly. Especially if you're working with non-citizen clients, effective counsel means understanding those shifting intersections between different areas of law.
Okay, so Stevens made a strong case for why deportation has to be part of the Sixth Amendment conversation. Now, I know Justice Scalia had a very different take. What were some of the highlights of his dissent?
Oh, Scalia's dissent is a classic. Sharp, witty, and very much in line with his textualist approach. He started by disagreeing with the majority's view of deportation as a direct result of the criminal conviction. He argued that it's actually a separate civil proceeding.
So he's drawing a line between what happens in criminal court versus immigration court.
Exactly. And based on that distinction, Scalia said requiring criminal lawyers to advise on deportation goes too far. It's beyond the scope of the Sixth Amendment, as he read it.
So his argument is the Sixth Amendment is about making sure you have a fair trial, not about every single possible consequence that could come down the road.
That's it, in a nutshell. And then he goes on to say, well, if we go down this road, where does it end? What other collateral consequences would lawyers be obligated to advise on? He even used the term logical starting point.
The slippery slope argument. Classic Scalia.
Right. He was worried about this ruling creating a huge burden for lawyers.
I see his point, for sure. If deportation is in, what else is fair game? This is a valid question.
And he had this great line. He said, this is a case in which a tack hammer is needed and the court swings a sledgehammer. He felt the majority was overreaching, you know, using a massive legal tool for a very specific problem.
I love that analogy. So Scalia thought there were better, more targeted ways to address the problem of inadequate counsel without rewriting the Sixth Amendment.
That's a great way to put it.
Okay, so we've got Stevens on one side, Scalia on the other. What about Justice Alito? He wrote the concurrence, right? Where did he fall on this spectrum?
Alito, he was the voice of moderation in this case. He agreed with the outcome that failing to advise about deportation could be a major problem. But he also shared some of Scalia's concerns about requiring every criminal lawyer to be an immigration expert.
Yeah, immigration law is a whole other beast. You can't expect every criminal defense lawyer to be fluent in it.
Right. And he used some examples to highlight that complexity, like those terms we talked about earlier, aggravated felonies and crimes involving moral turpitude. Figuring out if a specific crime meets those definitions, it can be incredibly difficult.
So Alito's acknowledging the complexity, but also trying to find a practical solution. What did he propose?
He suggested a pretty straightforward approach. At the very least, lawyers should advise their non-citizen clients that there could be immigration consequences and strongly encourage them to talk to an immigration specialist.
So it's like a warning label almost, a buyer beware for potential immigration issues. It doesn't put the whole burden on criminal lawyers, but it makes sure clients are at least aware.
Exactly. It balances those competing concerns, you know? The limits of a criminal lawyer's expertise, but also the client's right to be informed.
I like that. Okay, so we've got Stevens, Scalia, and Alito. three very different perspectives, each adding a layer of nuance to this already complex case. It's like a legal tapestry woven from these different threads of thought.
A beautiful way to put it. And what's so fascinating is how these different perspectives not only illuminate the Padilla case itself, but they also shed light on those bigger debates within the legal system as a whole.
Oh, like what? Give me an example.
We'll take the concept of judicial activism versus judicial restraint. Stebe's opinion, expanding the scope of the Sixth Amendment, that could be seen as an example of judicial activism, using the court's power to shape social policy. Whereas Scalia, he argued for a more restrained approach, sticking closely to the text of the Constitution.
So Padilla is not just about Padilla and deportation. It's about these fundamental questions of how courts should interpret the law and what their role is in society.
Exactly. It's a microcosm of those bigger debates that are constantly playing out in courtrooms across the country.
It's mind-blowing when you think about it that way. But that's what makes these deep dives so rewarding. It's not just about learning the details of a specific case. It's about gaining insights into the whole legal landscape.
It's like peeling back the layers of an onion, revealing all those hidden complexities.
I love that. Okay, so before we move on to talk about the lasting impact of the Padilla case, I want to circle back to something you said earlier. You mentioned that this case highlights the unique vulnerabilities of non-citizens within the criminal justice system. What makes them so susceptible to these kinds of issues?
Well, a lot of non-citizens simply aren't familiar with all the intricacies of U.S. law, especially that murky area where criminal law and immigration law intersect. They might not realize that a guilty plea, even for something seemingly minor, could have huge implications for their immigration status.
It's like navigating a maze blindfolded.
Exactly. And even if they do understand the risks, there can be language barriers, cultural differences. It can be really hard for them to communicate effectively with their lawyers,
yeah,
to ask the right questions, to really advocate for themselves.
So it's not just about the law itself. It's about access to information, about having clear communication, about trust between lawyer and client.
Absolutely. And all of that can be especially challenging for non-citizens who are often dealing with cultural differences, language barriers, and just a general sense of fear and uncertainty about their legal status.
It's a reminder that justice isn't just about having laws in place. It's about making sure everyone has a fair shot at navigating the system, regardless of where they come from.
Well said. And the Padilla case shows us what can happen when those safeguards fail.
Definitely a sobering thought. Okay, so we've explored those different opinions in Padilla. The reasoning of the majority, the dissent, the concurrence. We've delved into the complexities of the Sixth Amendment and the unique challenges faced by non-citizens.
We've covered a lot of ground, that's for sure. But the story doesn't end there. We still need to explore the impact of this decision, how it changed the legal landscape, and what questions it continues to raise even today.
And that is exactly what we'll do in the final part of our Padilla deep dive. But before we get there, I'm going to leave our listeners with something to chew on. A question to ponder.
A cliffhanger. I love it.
Well, you know me. Always got to keep them coming back for more. So here it is. If we accept that the Sixth Amendment requires lawyers to advise on collateral consequences, as the Padilla case suggests, where do we draw the line? What other issues might fall under that umbrella? And how do we balance the need to protect individual rights with the practical realities of the legal system?
Big questions, ones that legal scholars are still grappling with today. But for our listeners, it's a chance to reflect on the complexities of justice and the legacy of this landmark case.
Food for thought, folks. Join us next time for the exciting conclusion of our Padilla v. Kentucky deep dive, where we'll explore the lasting impact of this decision and its implications for the future of criminal justice. All right, welcome back, everyone, for the final part of our Padilla deep dive. We've spent the last two segments really digging into the legal weeds of this case. The facts, the opinions, the back and forth between the justices.
Quite a journey, for sure.
But now I want to shift gears and talk about what happened after Padilla. Because this decision didn't just impact one man, it sent ripples throughout the whole legal system.
It really did. Padilla is a prime example of how one case can spark all kinds of changes.
So what were some of the biggest changes? What were those ripple effects you mentioned?
Well, one of the most immediate impacts was on plea bargaining. Think about it. Before Padilla, a lot of non-citizens might have taken plea deals without really understanding they could be deported.
So no more plead guilty now, ask questions later.
Right. Padilla made it so lawyers couldn't just brush that aside. Plea bargains are all about strategy, right? You're weighing your options. But you can't make a good decision if you're missing a huge piece of information.
Yeah, that's like playing poker but not knowing the value of the chips.
Exactly. So Padilla made lawyers be more upfront about that risk of deportation, made sure non-citizens could make a truly informed choice.
Okay, so big changes for plea bargains. What about defense lawyers in general? Do they have to change the way they do things?
Oh, absolutely. Padilla basically threw a wrench into the whole criminal defense playbook. I mean, before you could be a criminal defense attorney and say, hey, immigration law, that's not my area. But after Padilla, not so much.
So criminal defense lawyers suddenly had to become at least somewhat knowledgeable about immigration law.
Pretty much. They had a duty to investigate those potential consequences, even if it meant talking to an immigration specialist or boning up on immigration law themselves.
So it was like a crash course in immigration for a lot of criminal defense lawyers.
Yeah. In a way, yeah. It forced them to think more holistically, to see how these two areas of law were intertwined. You couldn't just focus on winning the criminal case. You had to think about those downstream consequences, too.
Okay, so lawyers had to adapt, but what about judges? Did Padilla change anything for them?
You bet. Judges had to make sure defendants actually understood those potential immigration consequences.
Because before, it was probably just like, do you understand you're pleading guilty? Okay, moving on.
Right. But now, it wasn't enough to just ask that general question. Judges had to be more specific. In a lot of places, they started adding warnings about immigration consequences right into their standard plea procedures.
So like a built-in disclaimer.
Exactly. Transparency was key. The judge had to make absolutely sure the defendant was making a truly informed decision.
So we've talked about plea deals, lawyers, judges.
Mm-hmm.
But how did Padilla change the way we think about the Sixth Amendment itself? The right to counsel.
That's a great question. I mean, Padilla really pushed the boundaries of how we interpret that amendment. It made us think, what does effective assistance of counsel really mean? Does it just cover the trial itself, or does it go further?
Because deportation, that's a civil matter, right?
Yeah.
But it's often triggered by what happens in criminal court. So the court had to decide, is the Sixth Amendment just about the trial process, or does it cover those long-term consequences too?
And that's where you see those concurring and dissenting opinions really coming into play. You had justices like Scalia who were worried about going too far about expanding the Sixth Amendment so much that it becomes unworkable. But then you had Stevens who argued that, look, the legal landscape is changing and the Sixth Amendment has to keep up to truly protect people's rights.
So Padilla didn't just answer one specific legal question. It opened up a whole new debate about what effective counsel actually means in a constantly evolving legal system.
Absolutely. And the conversation's still going on today.
We're still figuring it out. It's like Padilla planted a seed and we're still watching the branches grow.
Great analogy. And those branches reach far beyond the courtroom, too. Padilla's had a big impact on how we think about access to justice, especially for non-citizens.
Yeah, we touched on that earlier. How did Padilla change that conversation?
Well, before Padilla, the focus was just on making sure non-citizens had a lawyer. But Padilla made it clear that wasn't enough. That lawyer had to be able to actually understand and represent their needs.
Right. It's not just about having a warm body next to you in court. It's about having someone who can navigate those cultural differences, those language barriers, those anxieties that come with being a non-citizen in a legal system that can feel very foreign.
Exactly. So Padilla pushed the legal profession to think harder about what it means to be culturally competent, to think about how to really bridge those gaps in understanding so that everyone truly has equal access to justice.
And it's not just about cultural competency, right? It's also about these broader questions of what happens after a conviction. What are those collateral consequences?
Right. Deportation's a big one, but there's others too. Loss of voting rights, trouble getting jobs, restrictions on certain licenses. Padilla made us confront those issues.
And think about how far those consequences reach. Should someone's life be totally upended by one conviction, even after they've served their time? It brings up these big philosophical questions about fairness and second chances.
It does, and Padilla didn't give us all the answers. But it definitely shifted the conversation. It made people think more deeply, more compassionately about the long-term impacts of those criminal convictions.
So from plea bargains to legal representation to these deep philosophical questions, Padilla really left its mark.
It's a classic example of how a single case can have such a huge impact far beyond the original courtroom.
So there you have it, folks. That's our Padilla v. Kentucky deep dive. We covered a lot of ground, from the legal nitty-gritty to the human stories to the broader implications for the justice system.
We explored those complex arguments, those challenges faced by non-citizens, and the evolving role of lawyers in our world.
We hope you learned something new, maybe challenged some assumptions, and got a better understanding of just how powerful one Supreme Court case can be.
Exactly.
Thanks for joining us. Until next time, keep exploring, keep questioning, and keep diving deep.